Podcast is made possible with support from Radio Maria and Downtown Champaign, with an international brunch, lunch, and dinner menu influenced by Caribbean, Asian, Indian, Spanish, and Latin cuisines. Radio Maria now features Sunday dinner with a different and unique menu every week. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. Each year, millions of songbirds migrate from north to south and back again. For a cliff swallow, that journey may cover 12,000 miles. How do these birds do it? On the program today, we're going to take a look at some of the latest research on migratory songbirds. Our guest is Miyoko Chu. She's an ornithologist and staff science writer at the Cornell Ornithology Laboratory, where she edits the lab's Birdscape newsletter and serves as the assistant editor of Living Bird magazine. She is also the author of Songbird Journeys, Four Seasons in the Lives of Migratory Birds. The book takes readers through the seasons and looks at the ways in which scientists track songbirds. Some very important work in this regard, by the way, has been done here at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Songbird Journeys also offers tips for bird watching through the seasons. And Chu says we can use some of the same tools and techniques that scientists use. Listeners, if you have questions about songbirds, give us a call this afternoon. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, you can call toll-free. The toll-free number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Songbird Journeys, Four Seasons in the Lives of Migratory Birds is Miyoko Chu's first book. The publisher is Walker and Company. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Miyoko Chu, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you, Celeste. It's great to have a chance to talk to you and your listeners.
Is the spring 2006 migration of songbirds underway yet?
Well, it's beginning underway farther south than we are. I mean, we've started to see some of our short-distance migrants arrive, but the huge waves of neotropical migrants are still on their way. We know from looking at radar images around the Gulf of Mexico that they'll start to cross the Gulf on a daily basis around April 8th. So we're coming up on being able to see them very soon.
Okay, a couple weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Not too long off at all. How long does it take that cliff swallow I mentioned in my introduction to fly from South America to the Yukon?
I don't know exactly how long it would take that cliff swallow. I suspect that it starts moving its way northward, perhaps as early as January or February. I know that in Nebraska, where I used to help miss net swallows and put bands on them, that they would tend to arrive in April. And so, you know, it doesn't take them too long to make all that distance, especially considering their small size and the incredible number of wing beats it takes them to get all that way.
Yeah. Which birds make the longest trips?
Well, the cliff swallows definitely can be one of the longest travelers. As a lot of your listeners probably know, you can find cliff swallows quite a bit farther south in the Yukon as well. But when they do go up all the way, that can be one of the longest distance trips. The bobolink is another amazing traveler. And one researcher totaled up how long a 9-year-old bobolink, rather old bobolink, how far it would have traveled over the course of its life, and it added up to something like going around the world 4.5 times. So that's one way to look at it. These birds are circling the globe in terms of distance within their lifetime, some of them.
Yeah, and many migrate in the dark.
That's right. It seems amazing enough that any bird could navigate its way across these vast distances, sometimes even returning to the exact same spot year after year. But when you think that they're doing it in the dark, to me, that's just incredible.
Yeah. Why do they do it in the dark?
Well, part of the reason has to do with just the energetics and physiology of being essentially a marathon runner up in the sky. If you think about how hard these birds have to work to fly and that they're doing it for hours on end, they're using a lot of energy, they're heating up, and they've got feathers on them, so they can become really quite hot. I think I read something about some birds in flight can get up to 111 degrees with their body temperature, which would be fatal for people. But if they're traveling in a cooler environment at night, that helps them out a lot. If they were trying to do this in the daytime, some of them wouldn't fare quite so well, especially over long distances when they can't land, like when they're going over the Gulf of Mexico.
Yeah. One of the things that strikes me about songbird journeys is a bird's work is never done.
That's true. They face challenges every day and every step of the way. And migration is a particularly dangerous time for them. That's when as much as 85% of their annual mortality may occur. But it sure doesn't get easy when they're breeding either. They have so much work to do once they arrive in terms of making, you know, possibly thousands of trips to build a nest and then thousands of trips to feed their young and to defend them against predators. It really is a year-round challenge, I think, to be a small bird.
Yeah. Back to migration. How much territory might a bird cover in the course of a night?
Well, there's been some really great studies that have radio-tracked thrushes. And these thrushes started out in Urbana in an orchard where researchers Dick Graber and Bill Cochran were capturing them and putting the transmitters on their backs. And, you know, it'd be hard to tell exactly how far a bird goes at night unless you really could fly with them. And that's exactly what they did. They put the transmitters on the bird, and these transmitters would emit beeps that they could detect with their receivers. And at night, the birds would take off, and quickly, the researchers would get into an airplane and go up in the air and try to detect that signal. They had to stay within 25 miles or they could lose the signal and the bird altogether. But they managed, in some cases, to track birds, you know, as far as 400 miles in a single night, following its signal and staying close up to it.
Yeah. That little wood thrush left Urbana at dusk, and by 10:37 that evening, the bird was over Evanston. And then it set out over Lake Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
So it was flying all night.
It was flying all night. I think actually that one was a gray-cheeked thrush, but it's a relative of the wood thrush.
Oh, okay.
And, yeah, it once it took off, it started heading on a certain bearing, and the amazing thing is that it kept that bearing all night long, and it was so accurate that as the pilot was trying to track the thrush, they got up near Chicago and started to lose the signal because of engine noise, and they lost the bird at that point. But because they knew its heading and because they knew that these thrushes tend to stay on a very straight course if the wind isn't pushing them off course, they were able to calculate where they would expect to find the bird after a certain amount of time had elapsed, and they took their airplane up there and waited around, and sure enough, the signal came in, and they were able to find the bird again. Now, at one point on this amazing journey, the bird started going out over Lake Michigan, and they had to turn back and refill with gas, thereby giving up the signal again. But they were able to relocate the thrush, and by that time, there was a severe thunderstorm, so that they were going in this airplane with thunder crashing and lightning sparking all over the airplane, and the thrush just kept going. It just didn't slow down, and it was on that that same bearing that it had taken ever since taking off from Urbana.
Yeah. Well, you know, thinking about flying across open water, you know, I think of weather and storms. And, you know, this month in this part of the state of Illinois, we saw tornadoes and a blizzard. Earlier this month, tornadoes. Then this week, a snowstorm. Mm-hmm. How do storms affect migrating birds?
Storms are one of the potential deadly hazards for migrating birds, and unfortunately, they can't always tell when those storms are coming. Now, if they're over land and they're over areas where they can stop, and they have to in an emergency, they'll probably be okay. And if it's not prolonged cold, they'll probably be able to find enough food to survive during that stopover period and take off when things clear up again. But it gets especially dangerous for them when they're trying to do something like a long overwater crossing over Lake Michigan or over the Gulf of Mexico, where once they launch out, you really go past the point of no return. It may be beautiful conditions in Mexico when they launch out over the Gulf, but there could be a storm coming down from the north that they just can't see, and they meet up with it partway. And in those cases, especially if there's a headwind, they can rapidly become exhausted and die during the flight.
Yeah. Back to Graber and his pilot, Jim Taylor, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Following that little bird through the night, what was that experience like for these two fellows?
Well, on the one hand, they were, I think, really excited about it. Graber remarked that he was following a thrush to some unknown destination. And keep in mind that no one had done this before. People had tracked large birds like ducks. But it was Graber who, working with Bill Cochran, an engineer, was able to get the transmitter small enough for the first time to actually do this. So I think there was probably the great sense that they were doing and going somewhere unknown, doing something that hadn't been done before, and they were going to find out some answers that they really couldn't find out any other way. You know, how high was the thrush flying? Did it go on a straight heading? How long would it go? All those kinds of questions. On the other hand, he was very anxious about the bird. He was really concerned for its welfare, particularly when it started heading out over the lake in that thunderstorm, and he started imagining all the things that could happen to it after it had traveled all that distance, you know, from South America or Central America and then up to Illinois and then from Urbana. It had gone all that way, and he had put a transmitter, a light one, you know, the weight of a dime, but on a bird the size of a thrush. He was worried that maybe that wasn't an inconsequential load to put on a bird, and he, in his mind, saw it fluttering down into the water and perishing in the lake. And he made a vow, I think, pretty much on the spot not to do it anymore. So that was the last thrush flight that he tracked.
Hmm. What other kinds of things have scientists here at the Illinois Natural History Survey at the University of Illinois contributed to the study of migratory birds?
Well, I know that there's scientists in collaboration with others, for example, have used some radio tracking technology in combination with energetic studies to find out, you know, how much does a bird expend in flight. People have done caged birds experiments to find out how much energy it really takes to fly. But once they had this technique down, another scientist, Martin Wachelski from Princeton, came along, and together they worked to use those tracking methods, along with a method called using doubly labeled water to measure energy expenditure in thrushes. And so what they were able to do is measure how much the thrush used on any given segment of its flight. And that was intriguing because it showed that these thrushes weren't really spending as much energy as some people might have thought. I mean, it seems to us a huge amount of effort for, you know, to migrate all these distances, but actually birds apparently are very efficient flyers, so that, you know, including the stopovers, a thrush was expending only 0.0003 calories per mile. And it's impressive when you think that they're that efficient.
Yeah, and one meantime, on the ground or in the air with in a plane, you need to stop and refuel to follow
these
characters.
That was such a challenge, just burning up fuel and trying to keep up with these creatures who were going above in the air.
Yeah. You say in the book Songbird Journeys, it's only been within the past 50 years that scientists have been able to go beyond the limits of what they could observe with their eyes and ears. You've mentioned now energetic studies and tiny transmitters. What else are scientists using in the way of strategies and technologies to learn more about migration?
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the greatest challenges, since a lot of these birds are migrating at night, is simply being able to see them. And so scientists have had to rely on technology in order to get a better sense of what these birds are doing. So one thing that they use is radar. And back in 1957, Sidney Gautreau, who was only 17 years old at the time, a bird enthusiast but not a professional ornithologist yet, he was watching television and saw a newscast in Louisiana that showed the first weather radar on the weather report. And as he was watching this report, he thought he saw these little white things moving back and forth that he thought were gulls off on the beach. And it got him thinking that maybe people could use radar to actually see bird migration, because until then, people had to take it on faith that birds were flying across the Gulf, for example. So he made friends with meteorologists at the local weather station and became one of the first people to actually witness mass migrations of millions of birds over the Gulf by looking at the radar screen. And those tools are still in use today to measure the volume and timing of migration, for example. Another way that we can see these invisible migrations is by listening with our ears. And there are now technologies to enable people to listen to the night sky with microphones and have these sounds recorded and also simultaneously turned into sonograms so that you can, for example, sit in your home, look at your television screen, watch and hear the calls. So that if you hear the high pitched call of a bird as it passes overhead, you'll see a little squiggle on your screen to indicate it as the sonogram, and you'll hear it from your loudspeakers. And you can automatically gather this data, and there are even programs to then quantify and even sort some of the calls. So you can then go and say, well, that was a great night for magnolia warblers over my house. Or, you know, any of your particular birds, you can look and see how many were actually passing over your own roof.
Is it difficult to do this?
Well, there are actually some instructions on a website of Bill Evans, who was one to really help set up these kinds of home stations. And you can do it following the instructions on the website. They tell you, you know, how to use a plastic dinner plate to help, you know, reflect the sounds around the microphone and how to mount it and what kinds of programs you can use to listen to it. So, you know, I think it takes a little bit of effort to get it started, but nothing that a motivated person couldn't do. And in fact, I think the great hope is that people will do this, not only for their own enjoyment, if they want to tune into night migration, but also because if we could get a network of these things on people's rooftops across the country, we could really learn a whole lot more about the patterns of migration across a very wide area and not just a few scattered points here and there.
So as amateurs, as backyard birders, we could make a contribution.
Yes, I think it would be wonderful to have those kinds of contributions for that, and there are many other ways that people can get involved too.
Yeah. Maybe we can talk about that a little later. Mm-hmm. I want to go back, though, to Sidney Gautreau. He began as an amateur, and he started tracking bird migrations over the Gulf, correct?
That's right.
And over the years, he compiled quite a lot of data that's very useful, very helpful. However, it tells us something that's disturbing, mm-hmm. that the numbers of birds migrating over the Gulf has dropped.
Right. His numbers indicated that the volume of migrations crossing the Gulf is about half that. It was about half that in the 1980s compared with what he'd seen in the 1960s. Now, there are some who argue a little bit about the details of that because, for example, he collected the data over a certain time period, and it was like a window, a snapshot. But nevertheless, when you see such a huge difference, you know, that gives you some cause for worry.
Yeah. How significantly have the numbers declined?
Well, it's hard for anyone to really tell. I mean, I think that study was certainly a good broad indication. If you look, I guess, on a species-by-species case, there's a publication by Partners in Flight listing declines of songbirds and other land birds. And they say that about 29 land bird species have declined by more than 50% since the 1960s. So if you think about it, that's a huge number of birds for those 29 species. There are also species that are undergoing declines that are less steep than that, and some, you know, that seem to be pretty stable, and even others that seem to be increasing. But we can see indication that, you know, unless we can reverse some of these trends, some of our birds are going to be in trouble.
Yeah. Do scientists have some understanding of why there's a decline?
Well, it's many factors all rolled together. And, of course, one of the biggest problems is simply the loss of places for birds to live and to migrate and to stop over on their migrations. So the amount of natural habitats that we've lost, not only here in the United States, but also in the northern boreal forests of Canada and in Latin America and tropical wintering grounds, pretty much everywhere you go, we're losing more and more habitats, which means fewer places for the birds to breed and raise young, and fewer places for them to survive the winter, and fewer places to find safety on the way in between.
Yeah. You know, the landscape can change dramatically over the course of a season, either due to the acts of people building, removing habitat, or due to an act of God. So what happens when a migrating population of birds lands in a landscape that has been so dramatically changed?
Well, their options are not very good if they're in an area that's been really changed, such as a housing development that leaves no food for them or shelter from predators. Now, if they're in good shape and they're migrating and the weather conditions are good, they have some options about where to land. So they can look around for the best green places and direct themselves there. So that's why in urban areas you can often find high concentrations of birds in parks. It's because they're flying over an area and they see all this development and maybe agricultural fields and all kinds of places that aren't suitable for them. And then small patches of woodlots or other areas that are suitable, and they'll tend to concentrate in those areas. But the real problem is when you don't have enough of those patches or enough large patches for them, and if they are exhausted, then they could easily perish once they land, and you know, either from predators or from hunger.
So it's difficult for them to adapt.
It is. I mean, on the one hand, they have the ability to be very mobile, so they can keep going a few extra miles if they need to find better habitat. But the thing is, with so many factors, like whether it's you know, bad weather that they run into, and perhaps they weren't able to find really enough food on their last stop, and they're just barely making it by on the last of their reserves, the more habitats we take away, the fewer options there are for them.
Yeah. Some years ago, I was able to visit a sanctuary for birds in the North Atlantic and the Arctic tern. There were Arctic terns that nested there. And the naturalist who gave the tour said that if the bird makes the return trip the following year, will want to nest in the exact same spot.
Mm. It's amazing that so many birds do this, not just terns, but a lot of songbirds, so that biologists know this because they can capture a bird and put an aluminum band, lightweight band around its leg with a unique number, or they can put colored leg bands so they can even tell the bird's identity without having to capture it and read that number again. And they found some astounding things, like one yellow warbler, for example, was found for 9 years in a row at the same spot at the Long Point Bird Observatory in Ontario. And we know that it probably came from somewhere as far as Panama, every year making that trip and going back to the exact same spot. And you wonder why, you know, with all the options it had, where there are yellow warblers hundreds of miles south of there, and, you know, lots of choices, why did it pick that one spot? And
yeah.
It's amazing.
And why would you, yeah, and it's apparently for the Arctic Tern, this fellow who was telling us, was down to like, you know, I mean, a particular patch of grass, one spot. You know, how does a bird do that?
Well, birds are amazing navigators. Even when they're young and have never made the migratory journey, they can get to generally where they need to go, but they become better navigators as they age and get experience. So those young birds, when they get out of the nest, they fledge, they get old enough to migrate. So in fall, they make their first trip. The obligate migrants, the ones that always go back and forth every year, have those instructions about where to go in their genes. They basically know to fly in a certain direction for a certain amount of time, and that gets them in the ballpark of where they need to be. But later on, they're able to use navigational clues like landmarks down on the ground, like the stars above, just the way we can navigate to the North Star. Birds look at the stars rotating around the North Pole to orient. They can see polarized light patterns that aren't visible to us, so that at sunset they may be able to use these polarized light patterns to orient. And then once night falls, they can use the stars, but even on a cloudy night, they've got a backup. They have a built-in compass, so that just like we can use a compass to tell north and south, they've got something inside that tells them north and south, and they can therefore keep going even when they can't see the stars.
Amazing. And to think that a yellow warbler could reach the age of 9 years and do this over and over again.
Yeah, I think the estimate was that it had gone some 45,000 miles. And 9 years old is really quite old for a bird of that age. I think he was the longest-lived yellow warbler on record. But, you know, assuming that they can live that long, they'll keep coming back to the same spots, particularly if they've raised young there before. If they fail, sometimes they'll strike out and try a new spot. But once they've, you know, raised young there, that's a strong incentive for them to come back, because generally life is short for a bird, and they can't take too many risks with losing their young.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is ornithologist Miyoko Chu. She is an ornithologist and staff science writer at the Cornell Ornithology Laboratory. She's the author of Songbird Journeys, Four Seasons in the Lives of Migratory Birds. She edits the lab's Birdscape newsletter and serves as the assistant editor of Living Bird Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn, and listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions about songbirds. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener waiting for us in Pasotum on line one. Hi.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
I have a question about purple martins. For years on our farm here south of Champaign, we would have pairs of martins migrate every year, come back. And some years be more than others, but about 4 years ago, 3 years ago now, I guess, they just completely quit. Mm-hmm. Normally there'd be scouts come in about April 1st, April 15th, right in there. And then they'd be back or they'd not be back, but we don't even have any scouts come anymore. Mm-hmm. And do you know if there's a particular problem that species has run into lately is the reason they're not coming back again?
I don't know about the larger picture of purple martins and whether there's something happening over a larger geographic area. I do know that perhaps once you lost your breeding pairs, which are known to be remarkably faithful, just they'll come back to the same house and apartment, as you probably know, year after year. And once something has happened to them, and you have an empty house, for example, you may have to start enticing the birds all over again. Mm-hmm. I don't know why you wouldn't be getting any scouts at all, though. I hope they do come back for you.
Well, it's been that way for a while now, and you're right about them coming back to the same place. There was one year, I remember, years ago, where we moved a house from one year to the next, and those birds would come fly around that same imaginary house that had been there in that same airspace.
Wow.
And they did that for 2 days before they finally gave up and came up to where we moved the houses. So it's quite remarkable. I don't know how. I don't think you've explained quite how they guide themselves yet, unless I missed that part, but it always intrigued me.
Yeah, well, they use this combination of factors. And one interesting thing about the magnetic sensing is that people aren't quite sure how birds sense magnetic fields, but they think it might involve the visual system based on recent studies, because if you put birds in red light, for example, they become confused, whereas in yellow or green light, they can navigate just fine. But I think with the combination of that compass and the stars and the landmarks and what must clearly be an amazing memory, they can look at the landscape and remember how to get back. And sometimes they follow the same migratory routes. So on occasion, you'll capture the same migrant, you know, in between its wintering and breeding grounds at the same place in different years as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, is there an organization around here that would know more in this particular area about martins in particular?
You might try the Purple Martin Conservation Association,
mm-hmm.
which is national in scope, but they will be able to at least give you the big picture and probably direct you to a local group that might have insights on your particular area.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you.
Thanks
for the call. Next, we talk with a listener in Rankin on line 4. Good afternoon.
Hi. I've got... Can you hear me?
Yeah, go
okay.
ahead.
It's very, very... quiet. I've got a selfish question. I was always curious how birds beef up before they take a long flight.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to apply it to my own self so I could put on some weight to do some heavy labor like they do. I was wondering if you could tell me the kinds and types of food requirements that they have.
Uh-huh. Well, I guess unfortunately for you, part of it has to do with your just not being a bird and having the hormones of a bird and all the amazing things, and I'll talk about that in a minute, because I think if you probably ate the diet of a bird, which would be perhaps insects and berries
oh.
and seeds, that it wouldn't help you much on that end. But it's true that when birds get ready to go down south, for example, they have to put on tremendous amounts of weight for their body size, especially if they're going to go out across the Atlantic, for example, which some birds do on their way to South America. And what triggers this are some hormonal changes that really cause them to become voracious. So they don't even just have to tell themselves, oh, I should eat more. They actually feel it, this gnawing need to eat. And so they'll gorge, especially on fruits that they can easily turn into fatty substances that are great for energy. And they'll do that until they're, you know, nice and fat. And then when they are in good enough condition, they know it's the safest time to go.
Excellent. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Next, we talk with a listener in Belgium on line 2. Hello.
Hello. Got a couple questions. One, have you ever visited the migratory bird sanctuary on Bolinas Headlands north of San Francisco?
Let's see, I have been to Bolinas because I'm from California and worked one summer in Point Reyes there.
Yes.
So I've been to Bolinas, but...
Yeah. That's one of those towns very hard to find.
It is, because as I recall, they purposely removed the sign so no one can find it.
Exactly. Exactly. There's an excellent bird sanctuary just north of Bolinas, right there on that headlands there, that you cannot believe how many birds are in that area. Because of the exact reason you say, that's hard to find habitat, you know, things that are very, very good for them. But the other question I wanted to bring up was that obviously this avian flu is going to affect our songbird population. It probably won't affect them this spring, but probably next fall when they intermix with the ones in the Arctic, and they'll bring it south with them, with the ones that go from Asia up into the Arctic, and then they'll all intermix and bring it down into us, more than likely. That will highly affect the population of the birds, just pretty much like, what was that, West Nile that got
mm-hmm.
into them pretty badly?
Mm-hmm.
Was that the one that seemed... Was
yes,
the last...
West Nile virus has affected crows a lot.
Crows, and what there's a blue jays and things like that, too, wouldn't there?
Yeah, they're the same family, I believe.
Yes, I think. they are. What's the word of that group? It starts with a C.
Corvids.
Corvids, yes.
Yes, that's it, the corvid group. Now, avian flu pretty much affects all of them, though, doesn't it? It's not specific to each group?
Well, we're so far seeing that it's mostly affecting shorebirds and, of course, the poultry industry. Mm-hmm. What we're not seeing so far is huge die-offs of songbirds. So I think we're going to have to see what happens if and when that virus gets here and how they affect our North American birds.
I see. That's truly sad. Obviously, we should never pick up a dead bird. Most people worry about eating poultry. That's not where the problem is. If you touch a dead bird, that's where the problem's at.
Well, at the moment with avian flu, there's no need for us to be particularly worried, but we always advise that you handle dead birds carefully, not only because of, you know, avian flu if it does get here, but also because there are other bird diseases that you don't want to transmit to yourself, even if it might result in a mild stomach ache. You know, it's just good protocol to always use a double bag, for example, if you have one, to scoop up the bird and then seal it tightly.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, we talk with a listener in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
I was wondering if you might say something about the work that Cornell does with ornithology. It's a rather famous lab, and just a few words to the public about it might be helpful.
Oh, that would be wonderful. I just love working at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, and it's a nonprofit organization supported by its members to do research, education, conservation, and citizen science. And what I love about this combination of things that we do is that it helps us understand birds on so many different levels, and we believe that the best way to conserve birds is to have people understand them, because by understanding them, that's when they begin to care about them. And so it takes this approach using different ways, both to educate people and engage them, to even ask them to contribute to science by observing birds and participating in one of our citizen science projects, and thereby give something for scientists to work with to in turn help the birds. So it's a nice integrative program that relies a lot on bird watchers, both to help us watch birds and help us conserve them as well.
I think they did a lot with early sonograms.
That's right. There's one part of the Lab of Ornithology called the Macaulay Library, which is the largest collection of natural sounds in the world, and now videos of most North American birds as well. This is online if you go to the Cornell Lab of Ornithology's website. And you can start to listen to some of the sounds in this collection. And there are all kinds of applications for the sounds and the sound research being done here besides listening for night migrants. For example, some of you may have heard that the ivory-billed woodpecker search is going on to find this bird that was rediscovered recently. They're using sound technology to try to find those birds. They're using sound technology to monitor migrants across wide areas of the U.S., and also for entertainment and education. Hollywood comes there to look for sounds of birds they can use in their movies, in Harry Potter and other movies, and teachers can go in and get sounds for their classrooms, or you can just go in and hone your birding skills by listening to what's there.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the question this afternoon. Next, we talk with a listener in Indiana on line three. Hi.
Hi. I'd like to have some questions answered, in particular the spelling of her name.
Okay. It's M as in Mary, I, and then Yoko as in Yoko Ono, and Chu, C-H-U.
Okay, I got that right. Now, the Songbird Journey is the title. Who's the publisher?
Walker and Company.
And what town are they from? New York or San Francisco?
Yes, it's in New York.
New York? Okay, thank you. And as it goes out, I want to get this, at least one of them, for a friend, because they'll go crazy about this book, that's for sure.
It's a good read.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you'd almost have to be. That's the kind of person I'm dealing with. It almost have to be. I'm sure it is. I think I got it all now. I'm going to double check here. Oh, website, is it CornellOrthodontologyLaboratory.com or what?
The website is www.birds, it's plural, B-I-R-D-S, .cornell.edu. And people will find things there about how to get involved, as well as an online bird guide that you can use. So when you start seeing those migrants come in, if you want to check out some sounds and photos and look at the maps to see where they winter, you can do that on the website.
Well, that's excellent. Well, I'll pass this on to my friend because there, in fact, she's out there now, you know, watching things and doing things. Okay, you mentioned Living Bird Magazine. Now, is that the title, those three words?
It's called Living Bird, and it is a quarterly full-color magazine with all kinds of stories about birds and travel and art and all things having to do with birds.
Okay. Okay, well, thanks a lot.
You're very welcome. And I do believe with a membership in the lab, don't you get the newsletter and the magazine?
That's right. There's an annual membership of $40 at the basic level that allows people to get this magazine as well as the BirdScope newsletter, which I edit, that will give people the latest updates from here as well as what our citizen science participants are finding out about birds.
Yeah, it does make a very nice gift because we got it as a Christmas gift last year. It was very nice, very nice gift. Let's talk before we run out of time about the kinds of projects that are out there that citizens can get involved in. What are some of the citizen science projects underway?
Mm-hmm. Right now, there's one called Project Feeder Watch, which is specifically for looking at birds at feeders, and that happens during the winter, and you report once or twice a week what you're seeing at feeders, and that's been going on for years so that people have a long-term record to look at. There's one called eBird that birders will be particularly interested in because you don't have to be at your feeders. You can be anywhere, and what you do is you make a list of the birds you see and you count them, and you go online to www.ebird.org, that's E-B-I-R-D.org, and for free, you get to put in your list, and the computer program will keep track of it for you, allow you to explore your own data over time by making maps and charts. And the best thing is that when you put that data in, it gets preserved in a central database that's accessible to any birder, any scientist, any educator on that website, so that your data become part of the overall continental picture of what birds are doing.
Hmm. And also at that website, will you find the information about listening for overnight migrations in your home?
That one is on a website called Old Bird. O-L-D-B-I-R-D. I'm not sure the URL, but if people do a search for Old Bird, they'll come up with that. That's Bill Evans' website, and it has the instructions there.
Okay, and also I suppose we could put into the browser Partners in Flight as another site that you mentioned, correct?
Sure. Partners in Flight, especially if you want to take a look at what's happening with bird declines, you can go to their website and download a PDF document showing a prioritized list of all North American land birds and the plans that people are putting in place to try to reverse those declines.
Mm, very good. And I think what we'll do this afternoon, or maybe tomorrow, it'll have to be tomorrow now, is I think what we could do at our website is put links to these sites that you've mentioned this afternoon so people can listen to this interview and then can go right and click on the links, and you can go right to these various websites. So we'll try and get that accomplished tomorrow. I'm sorry we're out of time. I want to ask you, though, one last question here, and we don't have a lot of time, and I know we could spend a lot of time on this question, is the songs of birds and how they differ from one season to the next. And what should we be listening for this spring?
This spring, you'll know when the birds are back because they'll wake you up bright and early in the morning, and it'll be like, you know, night and day, winter and spring, that you'll hear gorgeous songs, and you'll hear so many at once that it'll be hard. You'll have to concentrate to follow the thread of any particular one. And when you hear that, just think, you know, the birds have made it back again. They're ready to start attracting mates and perhaps even set up a nest in my yard.
Yeah. And one other thing. I said just one, but I have to ask you about this. There was I'm forgetting it now from the book Songbird Journeys, but a male yellow warbler going back and forth to the nest so many times over the course of a week or two. It is amazing. So what can we do in our backyards to provide fresh water, perhaps nesting materials, and food for these folks, or these birds, excuse me?
All of that, and I really strongly encourage people to try planting native shrubs and trees, because most of us have a lot of lawn, but that is really the least hospitable environment for birds to nest in. You want to get a lot of shrubs and trees in there so they have shelter, nesting places, and food.
And cover.
That's the difference. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Miyoko, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Miyoko Chu is the author of Songbird Journeys, Four Seasons in the Lives of Migratory Birds. The book is published by Walker and Company. And our guest, she's an ornithologist and staff science writer at the Cornell Ornithology Laboratory, where she edits the lab's Birdscape newsletter and serves as the assistant editor of Living Bird magazine. Again, Songbird Journeys, published by Walker and Company. 8 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time, settlement prices should be in.